Rebecca, I have an email from a patron here who wants us to answer some questions about whether or not therapists care and what sort of he really wants his therapist to start opening up with him and tell him more information about her. So I thought
he
might have some things to say about it. What do you say we talk about that today?
I'm ready.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Rebecca?
I'm Rebecca Bloom. I'm an author, a podcaster, a therapist, a parent, a fiber artist. I'm an Instagrammer.
Seattleite.
I'm a Seattleite.
An ex-Antiochian.
I like sushi.
Okay.
Yeah.
But not long walks on the beach because Seattle beaches are cold and windy.
Well, I always say if you want to go to the beach here, you need to picture that scene from the first Harry Potter movie where the big guy is delivering the letter and they're like in that cave at the beach and it's like, you know, huge storms and big, huge waves.
Yeah, that's the beach.
That's what it's like.
Except you have to add like the smell of dying seaweed.
I love that smell.
I do too, actually. When I live downtown and when I go to Antioch, which is downtown, every third time I'm down there, there's a good breeze coming in off of the sound, and you get that rotten fish, just dying seaweed smell, and it's just a hint of it just brings a smile to my face. So. A patron, anonymous patron wrote in, he says, "Hello, I am in therapy for the first time and feeling many intense emotions. Mm-hmm. Are therapists ever vulnerable to their clients? She seems so guarded as if she does not trust me. I really like her and I feel we have a good therapeutic relationship though. I have been seeing my therapist for over a year now and it has got to the point where I am basically obsessing over her. I really feel like I want more from my therapist now and for her to be herself and comfortable around me and to share more about herself." Rebecca, what do you think?
I would say that's not her job.
What is her job?
Her job is to be a blank slate so that you can project all your kookiness all over her. What do you think's going to happen if you know her better? Because actually the therapy's not going to get better. The fact that you know nothing allows you to say all kinds of things. It's actually what brings a certain type of balance to the therapeutic relationship, is that it's all about you. It's okay that it's all about you.
Right.
Enjoy it.
Why do you think he wants more of her? Why do you think he wants her to be more open about her life and her feelings and stuff?
Well, for some people, they think they would be more open if their therapist was more open. It's not like a competition, but it's just like, I just talk about myself all the time and I'd feel so much more comfortable if I knew something about you. But really, that's not the case. It's, he has some blocks for a reason and it's easy to project those onto the therapist instead of taking responsibility and saying, I'm stuck for whatever reason and I'm also obsessed with you. I'm sure any therapist would love to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the one question he's asking is, are therapists ever vulnerable to their clients? And the answer I have to say is yes. Certainly you have therapists that – it depends on what we mean by vulnerable. But yeah, there's a spectrum of vulnerability that therapists will generally have with their clients. And different therapists will probably have different levels of vulnerability with different clients. It depends on your approach. But the issue at hand the way I would frame it is, one, what are you comfortable with as a therapist to do? Two, what's your general approach and how does vulnerability fit into that? And then three, what's the harm? And four, what's the benefit? So for me, if a client were to ask me to be quote unquote more vulnerable, I would have a long conversation about that. And if I determined that a little bit of vulnerability might go a long way, I might talk about my own if they wanted to know my own personal opinion on a political topic or something, if I felt like it was going to help him. There's a chance that I might reveal that, but it would always, in the back of my head, I'd be like, make sure this isn't going to ruin the relationship and make sure that this is actually going to help, you know? And there's an option there of just being like, you know what? I don't think ultimately that's what you really want. I think you have an urge for that, but I don't think that that's going to help you. So it really depends now, but I would never just be like vulnerable in the way that I think this guy wants her to be vulnerable, which is, let's just be friends, you know,
right.
let's have me sit down and I ask you about your life and you ask me about my life. And we both cry together sometimes and we both, you know, we're equals and it's a friendship. And so that I would never do with a client, not because I don't want to open up, because actually there's part of me that would love to turn all my clients into my friends, you know, to have like, you know, 10 friends a week that I could just open up to and say whatever I want to with, for sure. That'd be great. But they would, one, not benefit from that, and two, be harmed by that, and three, no one would want to see me after that. They'd be like, right, my therapist talks about himself too much, which is a very common complaint that I will hear from clients. You know, they'll say like, you know, I have one complaint about my therapist. He talks too much. You know, it's like something that clients typically don't like in the end. Another question this patron is asking is, can I ask my therapist to be vulnerable and to put her guard down with me? And my answer to that, well, what's your answer to that, Rebecca?
I would say no. They work hard all day and that guard is up there for a reason. Like, you would never say to a construction worker, like, could you just take your helmet off, like, just for me?
Yeah.
It's like, no, they need that helmet on.
Right.
Like, that's their job.
Right, yeah. The way I would phrase it is, yeah, you can ask, but she's likely to refuse, you know. Yeah. You know, as a therapist or as a client, you can ask whatever you want to ask, aside from being scary and abusive and creepy. Yeah, you can ask questions like that, but don't expect to have her say yes, you know, is the way I would phrase it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it says more about you than it does about your therapist.
Right.
So just get ready for your therapist to let you know that that's a interesting question.
Right.
Because it opens up, you know, like, well, what relationships have you had in the past that are really intimate?
Right.
Are you trying to practice something with this therapist? Is there something that's really intriguing about this therapist? Have you never been in a relationship before that's so one-sided? Is that what's overwhelming for you? Yeah, I mean, it's those boundaries are there for a reason, because, you know, I'm seeing many, many clients a day. And so that consistency of having that kind of boundary up, it just allows me to have it with everyone, if that makes sense. Like, if I had to think like, oh, this is the client I let my boundaries down with, you know, like, there's a good chance I would forget and do it in the next session. But there's kind of like a way of being that I have to be all day to do this work, if that makes sense. And being pretty distant is part of that. And whenever I start talking about myself, I have to remember to shut up. Let it go back to the client, because that's why they're here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that he's experiencing a common phenomenon of clients. I went back and forth with him for a bit, and he told me that he was emotionally neglected his entire life. He's about 30, and he's never had really a close, intimate, caring relationship with someone. And, you know, so he's coming from that place of deficit and has tremendous need and thirst for intimacy and closeness and security, and he deserves that. And when he goes to therapy, thank God, he encounters someone who is listening and who doesn't reject him and who allows him to be who he wants to be. And he naturally wants to be even closer to her because it feels so good. And he has this impulse of like, okay, this feels great. How great would it feel if I was even closer to her is kind of the thinking he has. But what he doesn't realize is is at least consciously before communicating with me and maybe some other people, is that friendship, the closer, if you know, if you want to turn this person into a friend, friendships are two-way streets. They now involve her needs, and so you would have to care for her needs. And what if she doesn't like the way you care for her needs? Mm-hmm. And then she's like, I don't like this person. I don't want to hang out with this person anymore. Or she has other people in her life that meet her needs in ways that you could never meet. And so if you were to truly become friends, which of course would not happen or wouldn't be recommended, the chance of the relationship lasting very long is actually not very high. The chance of a therapeutic relationship lasting a long time is actually extremely high. As long as the therapist doesn't move and you don't move and blah, 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 like you could potentially have a relationship with your therapist that lasts for decades. And every step of the way, it could be healing. Whereas if you turn it into a friendship, the chance of that particular friendship lasting for decades is not very high. Mm-hmm. And also that the healing nature of it will not necessarily be as present, you know, because she might say, if she's truly herself, she might say things you don't like. And you're going to be like, you know what, I've lost some respect for her and I don't really like her in that way. And she kind of annoys me and it's all about her all the time, you know, and then the relationship falls apart. And so there's a real huge benefit to having a relationship like this. Now, for the patron, you definitely deserve a lot of relationships, you know, not just this one. You deserve to have romantic relationships. You deserve to have family members who have a mutual caring. You deserve friends who mutually support each other. You deserve colleagues, and you know, you deserve a lot of enriching, close, intimate, helpful, supportive relationships outside of this therapeutic relationship. The problem is, from the sound of it, you only have one of those relationships and it happens to be with a therapist. And so you're pouring all of your energy into that relationship and hoping that it will meet all of the other needs that you deserve to have met. And hopefully over time, you can start to cultivate relationships outside of the therapeutic relationship that can begin to meet those other needs that are more appropriate for those other kinds of relationships. Does that make sense, Rebecca?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say to view this relationship with this therapist as practice for hopefully other beneficial relationships you'll have in the future.
Right.
And that part of the practice is practicing what it's like to feel intimate. He's getting this practice. It's kind of like in a batting cage. It's like a one-way relationship. But to know that, you know, I am such a different friend than I am a therapist. You know, just the other night, my friend came over with a really big problem. And I was too tired. I was like, I don't know. Let's just pull a tarot card. Like, I'm so sorry, but like, I got nothing for you.
Let's pull a tarot card.
That was actually my answer.
Did you do it? Did you pull a tarot card? What did it say? Fuck off. I don't want to hear anymore.
No. What happened? They like the tarot card. They got something out of their tarot card.
Do your friends ever say, but you're a therapist. You're supposed to be a good listener.
I think by now, anyone who's friends with me knows that, I mean, and some of my friends I have endless energy for. Like, I also get those, you know, I mean, I get stuff. Oh, my God. I get texts like, my son, I just looked over at my son's phone and he's texting with his friend about cutting. What should I do? You know, like, I mean, I get that stuff, but I think everybody gets that stuff. But I guess as a therapist, I feel a little bit more like, oh, I should jump in and help and do whatever I can. You know, it's a friendship and therapy. It's just really different. And I often say that to my clients, like, you could have this conversation with any of your friends. What do you want to bring to therapy today? You know, like, it should be different. It's a very different type of relationship.
Oh, interesting. So when a client sits down and just kind of talks about their day in a way that they would talk to a friend, you will confront them on that and say, what are you avoiding? Or how about you use the time more, you know, more helpfully and more in line with therapy? Is that what you're saying?
If there's something really big going on, you know, I'll say, what's most important for us to talk about today?
Yeah.
Because I understand it's important. Like, sometimes you just chit-chat. But, you know, they can probably chit-chat with a lot of people.
Yeah. The few clients I can think of off the top of my head who would do that sort of thing were all of them were really wanting me to confront them on that every time. I had a client who it was a routine that we just went through. She would sit down, and I loved her. She was a long-term client and very fond of her, but she would sit down and she would sit down, and for the first 15, 30 minutes, she would talk to me in a way that was the way she would talk to a friend or a coworker or something, just sort of catching up, you know, this is what happened this week and this is what I did. And then I would always ask as a routine, so how are you feeling this week? How are you feeling today? It was just a simple question, you know, how are you feeling today? And that's all I had to ask. And she would instantly start to cry and would instantly tell me, it would instantly go deeper, you know? And it would just became a routine. And I realized over time that she needed a bit of time to get comfortable, I guess. And it's because if I just started at the gates of like, how are you feeling? She would sort of force the conversation back to the surface stuff for a while. And I determined that's our gig. That's our thing, you know, and that's great. And there's nothing wrong with that. But she would, I know, and she would tell me explicitly that she really appreciated that I would take the risk and ask her instead of, cause I would have got paid the same if I just stuck to her, talking about her week. And honestly, it would have been a lot easier for me. And I could have, you know, talked about my week too, and she probably would have been fine with that. And so, but I, you know, as you're saying, we have a professional responsibility, even perhaps a moral responsibility to confront clients when they do that stuff and get them to use the time for what they actually really want to use the time for. So So I go back and forth with the patron about this, and I'm telling him basically in a shorter form what we're saying now. And I'm saying, you know, look, I get that you want to be close. I might have even said something like, this is actually similar to the way that some clients will fall in love with their therapist.
Yeah.
And because what he's talking about is very akin to that. He's not saying love or lust, but he's saying he's obsessed with her, you know.
Right. Which, fascinated.
Yeah. Which sounds, you know, adjacent to romantic attraction or something. And the hypothesis that always seems to be borne out over time is that the client, because of emotional neglect in their life, when they finally come to us and we don't reject them and we listen really well and we're interested and we exude caring and empathy, that for the first time in their life, they are looking at, they're sitting across just a couple feet away, you know, eye contact galore with another human being once a week who cares, and they, all of these needs come pouring out and all of these feelings of gratification, like, oh my God, this person makes me feel so good. This person is soothing a part of me that has been aching my entire life. I want to be with this person forever. I want to be with this person 24/7. And of course, the client has that reaction because it's logical, but it's not wise, you know, is the thing. But it's logical, but it's not wise. And it's up to the therapist to help clients understand that and to ride that balance between, you know, definitely establishing the boundary while at the same time valuing the client's feelings, which is a difficult place to be depending on how intense the feelings are from the client. And I've been there many times. I've had many clients who have expressed that, and when it happens, I'm totally comfortable with it. It doesn't freak me out. You know, it's like a client will, at the, I guess at the extreme end, the client will say, you know what, I think I'm in love with you. Mm-hmm. Or they'll just give me the impression that they have, I don't know, just they're thinking about me a lot. Let's just put it that way. And that's normal. When I go to my therapist, same thing. You know, like there are times when I've gone through that as well. And there's nothing strange about it. It's just an indication of a need that has not, that's not being met and hasn't been met. And that's okay. So we go back and forth and he's like, you know what? I get it. You know, this patron's like, I think I understand. And he said, you know what? I've also been asking other therapists about this as well. I haven't just been asking you, Kirk. So he sent me a correspondence between him and this other therapist that he found. I don't know how, I'm not going to say the name of the therapist. He gave me the name, but, and it looks like a legitimate therapist, but, and I'm just going to quote what this other therapist said. So strap yourself in, buckle up for this one.
Okay. Rebecca. There's going to be a sound effect.
Okay. So he says, once in a while, I like telling the truth about therapists. For the most part, they're con artists, nothing more.
Oh, this is the therapist, is this?
Yeah, this is the therapist telling the patron, you know, his advice. For the most part, they're con artists, nothing more. A passive-aggressive set of people that won't allow you to peek behind the curtain. I would venture to say that 98% of all therapists are simply there so they can... so you can buy them a boat. They simply want to build up enough patience to have a secretary, have the right furniture, and be able to take off whenever they want. Most therapists don't really care about helping you. They care about solidifying their station in life. They're corporate robots for the most part. And this is the exact reason most of them do not like me, because I actually help my clients. I don't need to spend years and years helping a client. Only about 3% of individuals in therapy actually need therapy. A lot of analysts have simply become the lost parent that the child needs to talk to once in a while. The lost parent that isn't threatening and you don't know any of their foibles. So, Rebecca, what do you think about this?
Where's my boat?
Yeah, that was the first thing I thought too. It was just like... I don't know. I don't think I know a single therapist who owns a boat. Like
I do know one.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Is it a good boat?
It's a good boat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's not very common for therapists. I mean, my first thought was this therapist is in New York or something where people can charge outrageous amounts of money. And this is not how I experience most therapists. And I feel like most of my clients really need to be in therapy.
Right.
I way over 3%.
Right.
So I can see why this person wrote your client right back, because it really feeds his ego to let out this secret.
Right.
I love the quote, once in a while. Like, I don't think it's once in a while. I think probably lots of people hear this from you.
Right. Yeah, I've heard this. So reading between the lines, this therapist is probably – he probably calls himself a brief therapist or a solution-focused therapist or a postmodern therapist or something. There's a certain group of therapists who are dogmatic about brief therapy and – I'll say as a caveat, I am a firm believer and user of these theories, but the culture of some of these individuals is so annoying to me that I don't like to associate myself with them. And this guy is talking exactly the way that I've heard this exact same speech from so many, and it's usually men, by the way.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say this whole thing is so male.
Yeah,
I help my clients. I'm like, yeah. Of course you do, because you're a man and the clients are compliant, whereas most female therapists have to deal with all kinds of things that you could never imagine. But go on.
Right, and it's this. I think what happens to a lot of people is like this is they enter the field of counseling and they don't know anything about theory, right? They're just like most people, they just enter and then they get exposed somehow, or their program is only designed to teach brief therapies. There are certain programs that, particularly family therapy programs, I would say like, I don't know, 5-10% of family therapy programs are completely dismissive of other theories and will only teach solution focused or narrative or Milton Erickson or these kinds of things. And what ends up happening is this echo chamber among them, and they're sometimes attacked by the outside. So it's not like they don't have reason to sort of strike back, but they end up saying all these same sentences, like, you know, most therapists are in it for the money and they want to make clients dependent, and therapy is, you know, good therapy is brief therapy. And if you're, you know, if you're with a client for longer than a couple months, then you're either just trying to suck them dry for money, or you're trying to make yourself feel better, or, you know, there's just all these statements that, of course, I will say can be true at times. It's not like it's not an option or not a possibility for a therapist to be all about money and to suck their clients dry. But to blanketly label 99% of the profession as all corporate goons who are in it for the money and just trying to make clients dependent is like empirically incorrect. And so he's just talking like that. But anyway, so just to get into the specific quotes, because I just love all this stuff. It's just such an arrogant mansplainer prick of a person. I mean, all I could think of when I was reading this was just arrogant prick. That's all I could think, was just like this guy's the definition of arrogant prick. You know, it's like Jiminy Cricket. So, quote, "Once in a while, I like telling the truth about therapists. For the most part, they're con artists, nothing more. A passive-aggressive set of people that won't allow you to peek behind the curtain." So to that, I'm like, con artists? Like, wow, where does that come from? And then passive-aggressive, I'm not even sure what the point there is, right? Like, what sort of aggression are therapists universally, passively?
I think this guy got dumped by his wife, who was a therapist.
And or has that's gotten to a lot of...
And she got the boat. I think that's what happened.
And or he's been in a lot of verbal arguments with other therapists like you and I, who take issue with his arrogant, prickish attitudes. But before going on with this email, I want to take a break. What do you say?
All right.
All right, back from the break. If you haven't already become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. When you go there, become a patron of podcast Psychology in Seattle, and you'll get access to hundreds of deep dives that are only for patrons. There are episodes that only patrons can listen to. And you also don't have to listen to a majority of the ads, and also know that a portion of your pledge goes towards various charities that we support.
Do they still get the mug?
If you're a $20 patron, you get a mug. Also,
if you want to know what I look like, you should get the mug.
Well,
because I'm on the mug.
You are actually on the mug, and you can just go to our website and see a picture of you.
Oh,
Psychology in Seattle. Also, there's a live event that we're having in Seattle. Did you know about this?
No, you don't tell me anything.
Well, we just scheduled it. People have been asking for a live event for a long time. We've been doing the podcast for 9 years, and so
that's amazing. Your level of commitment.
Yeah. And over the years, I've always been like, I don't know, like, who would want to come? And, you know, what if I plan the event and no one comes, or one person comes, or what? How am I supposed to entertain a group? Say 100 people come. What am I supposed to do? I don't know. Do we just do a podcast in front of them? That sounds really...
I think that's what you do.
Lately I've been going to other podcast live events, like other podcasts that I like, and I've been learning And
from the masters.
Yeah. And I've been like, oh, okay, I could see doing something like that. And then I was just, every once in a while, I just sort of daydream about the podcast. And I'm like, huh, I wonder, because I sent out a survey to all the patrons. And one of the major takeaways was a lot of patrons wanted a live event. I'm just like, okay, you know, how do I make this happen? And
how do I please my fans? It's so overwhelming.
I definitely want to do it, but I just don't know what I'm doing is the thing. And so, and then I was like, okay, well, where would I have it? And the venue that always would pop into my head was the Rendezvous. Do you know the Rendezvous?
Oh, yes. That'd be a rowdy event.
Well, because they have like three different rooms you can rent. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in the back. And as a band,
It shows you how little I know that the Rendezvous is a back room.
Yeah. As a band person, I have rented their band room before to, you know, essentially, like, I think for $100, you rent this back room in this bar, and it looks like an old porn theater is what we called it. Mm. It's got like red curtains and everything. And then you charge $5 cover. And then, you know, if you make $300 revenue, then you take $200, you know, it's just kind of, you, so you pay the, and they give you a sound guy and everything. And it's kind of cool that way because you don't have to deal with bookers and in other venues and stuff. But anyway, so I sort of knew about those venues and I was thinking, well, what about that? And then I thought, well, it's at a bar and the Rendezvous is kind of sleazy in some ways. And I thought, you know, that seems kind of funny. And then it just popped into my head. I was like, why not have it at Antioch?
Yeah.
Because I'm a professor there and
you get free space.
Yeah. And I know that I know administration and I've worked a lot with the marketers and everything. And so I reached out to the marketing director and I was like, what do you think about having a live event at Antioch? And she was totally up for it. And so they're going to turn it into like a recruitment thing for Antioch uh-huh. for prospective students, but it'll be a live event that I won't have to pay rent for.
We'd love that.
Yeah. And you know, there's a lobby and then they're going to have like Antioch employees are going to work the door and stuff. Cause they're also going to invite prospective students who don't even know about the podcast, you know, like come check out what one of the professors is doing kind of a thing. And so it's this, you know, perfect scenario. And then I'm also thinking, like, if this works out, why not do it more times? This is probably more information than anyone ever wants to know. But
I'm fascinated.
And
we're
in the new building. Yeah. So part of this is me telling that you got to go. You have to be there.
Yeah.
Because I just, at least I'll know one person will be there is the thing.
So when is it?
So it's January 27. And it's going to be either at 1 or 3. I'm not sure when, but
I got to put this on my schedule right now.
Yeah.
Done. Okay. January
27.
It's a weekend. Very good.
Yeah. So
don't go to my NIA class. Okay. What time?
Afternoon sometime. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm fiddling around at the time, but more details to come essentially. It'll only be for an hour or two or something. And then I was thinking dinner in Belltown and then maybe karaoke somewhere.
Ooh, this is like a night on the town.
Yeah. Get a babysitter.
Like more fun than I've had in a long time.
Yeah.
But you and karaoke. We've never done karaoke together.
Wow.
And, you know, Tom Petty karaoke has gone to a new level. And so I'm really ready.
What's your Tom Petty jam?
My Tom Petty jam
Refugee? American Girl? Free Fallen. Awesome.
Because for some reason, I don't know why this is, but I've got really good breath control, and I can do the Free Fallen for like a really long time. Like it's kind of my
free.
Just like go. It's my signature move is to just keep, while everybody else is doing everything else, I'm just like Free Fallen. Like on my own,
and you're holding that note for
that note. I'm just, and it's a crowd pleaser. I have to say,
yeah, it's a great song. So, right. So this is 2018, by the way, January 27, 2018. Depending on when you're listening to this episode,
right. You could be listening to this like 10 years in the future,
right? And if you are, congratulations on a different president. And
I hope that like the sea is not lapping at your front door. But
well, that's a guarantee. So if you manage to, you know, get above the sea line, yeah.
Apocalypse. And there's still bees. I hope there's still bees. And
yeah. It's funny that we can laugh about these things, you know.
Oh, they're so horrible.
Yeah. Now, I've sent out some announcements over Patreon and the Facebook page and stuff, and people have been emailing, and they're just like, you know, where do I stay? And I don't know. Well, that's the answer to that question. But I do know that there's a pretty popular hostel downtown Seattle, which isn't too far. It's probably just, I don't know, 5 or 6 blocks away.
You could probably get a deal with one of the hotels that are right there.
Maybe. Called the Green Tortoise. Do you know the Green Tortoise Hostel?
I have ridden on that. That's like for people are in a serious budget.
Yeah.
But also people should know, like, this is an Airbnb town.
Yeah.
And you could probably get a cool – here's my advice.
Okay. Lay it on me.
If I was booking your trip, if this was my Pinterest page, you know, get a cool Airbnb on Capitol Hill or in Belltown. And, like, really, if you're coming to Seattle for the first time, this is a fun town. Maybe not in January so much. Bring your muckalucks and your heaviest parka. But, you know, you're going to eat some good food and meet some nice people and drink some great coffee. And we should come up with a restaurant list where people should eat while you're here.
Yeah, Capitol Hill, Belltown, Airbnb, or, I don't know, Queen Anne, Ballard. You can get Airbnb. I'm guessing Ballard has cheaper Airbnbs. Or just get an Airbnb up in North Seattle or south, you know, further from downtown, and take Ubers all over town. It's a great place to visit. Yeah, I scheduled it for January 27 because it is after the finals of the NFL and the weekend before the Super Bowl.
So you think people will be free?
Right. It's actually the weekend of the Pro Bowl, which no one watches. So,
no. Yes.
So it's free for that, for selfish reasons as well. But yeah, I'm planning on basically having a presentation with a number of different elements. Because when I go to other live events, that's always kind of the thing. You know, you have different segments, right? So maybe I'll do a monologue. I'll work up like a monologue for a bit. Maybe we'll play some tougher bluffs. Maybe there'll be maybe we'll show some pictures. And I was thinking about having like team tougher bluff in the audience, you know, like East versus West or something, mm-hmm. you know, to do the Pro Bowl kind of deal. And then Q&A and pictures afterwards. I'm thinking about actually hiring a photographer. And I'm also thinking about like having some major announcement that you can only get if you're at the live event.
Oh.
And I'm also planning on not recording it, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
You have to be there.
Yeah, because I don't want to have to worry about that, because it's such a pain in the ass to record an event like that. And it's also really a pain in the ass to edit it, because – live events have long strings of time of dead air, you know, as you're, you know, especially if you're doing crowd work, you know. And so if you want to come now, if you're like, oh, my God, I want to come, but that weekend, you know, it's my brother's wedding. What do? We're going to do other, if this goes well enough, we're going to do other live events that I have in my head. If this goes well, it would be logical to at least do it once a year, if not a couple times a year. And if it goes well for Antioch, then they'll gladly go along with it. And as long as people come every time, it's and especially if I do this a number of times, it'll be a lot less effort on my part. And mm-hmm. and so the payoff will be great. Because for me, what I'm really looking forward to, selfishly, because it's all about me anyway, is meeting people. Mm-hmm. I occasionally will meet listeners, but it's very rare. It's unless they're a student at Antioch or they're like my mom, it's pretty rare that I'll actually get to meet the listeners. And to me, the podcast, at its core, is basically a conversation between me and the listeners. You know, they email me. We're responding to an email with a listener right now. That's where all the meaning for me comes from. You know, I wake up in the morning and the first thing I do is I read and respond to emails from listeners. It's just like, and you just know that since that's what I do, I like to do it, you know, because I could totally avoid it and just be like, well, you know, I'm not going to respond to that email or whatever.
Yeah, the amount of listeners, the amount of time that Kirk puts into this podcast is astounding. It's a labor of love for him, and he's been doing it a really, really long time. And this live podcast is a celebration of his life's work, which is this podcast.
Wow.
So I think you should show up.
Yeah, wow, I hadn't thought about that. Birdo will obviously be there round out the situation. You'll be there, Rebecca, which is awesome. I'm guessing my parents will be there because they come to everything that I do.
And in classic form, my parents will not be there because I don't have those kinds of parents.
Yeah, they came to my dissertation defense. They came to like a lecture I gave at Antioch once.
God bless them.
Yeah, I don't really invite. I'm not like telling them they should come, but they're just like, well, of course we're gonna go. You know, they came. My dad went to every football game I ever played, and he would even go to practices and stuff. Like, my parents are just very dedicated.
They're attentive, and you can see that in Kirk's personality now. Good, solid parenting.
Where I'm arrogant and full of myself because my parents.
And you can see in my sassy, bitter nature that I come from a divorced household.
So my Burl, you parents, I'm guessing other faculty at Antioch will be there. I've yet to tell them about that.
But they're going to show up.
hopefully. And so, so I don't know. As I talk about it, it sounds like a very intimidating, scary event, and my armpits are starting to sweat a little bit about it. But
well, let me tell you one skill I would volunteer at the event, which is I'm really good at that part in Pictionary, like where you have to do the blindfolded drawing or draw with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
So if that's a skill you need, you know, a party trick you need during the event, like maybe, you know, just to kind of as people are settling in, you can give me like a drawing task and I'll do it with my eyes closed. I'd be willing to volunteer to get the crowd warmed up with that one. So
that sounds like I'm going to put that on the agenda. Just it's number one. Actually, we're just going to do that for like 2 hours. It's just going to be me saying random things to Rebecca while she can't see and she's just drawing pictures. That's the whole event.
I think it's like theater of the absurd. I think it's going to be a big hit.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it, and hopefully people will be there. And honestly, even if just a couple people come locally, I'll still enjoy it. Because like I said, one of the major barriers in the past was me worrying that I would actually have to shell out money and then no one would come. In this instance, it's just at Antioch and I don't have to shell out any money. And so if no one comes, it's just like, oh, okay, well, that's that. Never do that again. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not any, you know, expense to me, I guess. And so, So January 27, I guess there's a chance that if some people are traveling and getting maybe here on Friday, we might do a Friday night thing too. I don't know. We'll see. Keep listening and watch the Facebook. I'll probably make an event page on Facebook to keep track of everything. So like the Psychology in Seattle podcast Facebook page. It's just called Psychology in Seattle. There's a Psychology in Seattle fan group, which is different, but anyway. Okay, so let's go on with this email. So this is another quote from this fella who emailed the patron, this brief therapist. I would venture to say that 98% of all therapists are simply there so you can buy them a boat. They simply want to build up enough patience to have a secretary, have the right furniture, and be able to take off whenever they want. And again, as you said, who owns a boat?
Who has a secretary? I do everything. I do my billing. I answer all the calls. I, you know, photocopy stuff for DHHS and send it off. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. 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 Do you know a single therapist who has a secretary?
No. And in fact, on TV shows where therapists have secretaries, I can't watch them anymore.
Right. Because it's like ridiculous. Why would you have a secretary when they would just be filing their nails all day because there's nothing to do? You know, there's so little to do. Now, the times when there have been a quote unquote secretary or receptionist or office worker is when there's an office of 10 or more therapists, and there's a lobby and there's clients coming in and out all the time. But even in situations, I have friends and colleagues who have group practices where there's like 20 therapists working in a particular office and they all share the same lobby and they don't have a receptionist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an expense that makes no sense in our field is the thing. Now, if you wanted a billing person, they don't have to work in your office. You can send everything to that billing person and they'll take care of it from wherever they're at. So this is when I get to the part in this email where I'm like, is this guy actually a therapist or not? Because he seems to have a cartoonish version in his head of what a therapist is, you know? Like buying a boat and having secretaries sounds like he's watching a lot of TV about therapy, you know what I mean?
Or he lives in Connecticut. I mean, that's my other thought. Like, this is like an East Coast thing going on, and it's so far from the world that we live in that we just can't imagine it, but it you know, it exists in another parallel world.
Interesting. Now, psychiatrists will sometimes have receptionists because they have a tremendous amount of paperwork that they have to manage, and so psychiatrists sometimes will have secretaries, but anyway. So another quote here is, most therapists don't really care about helping you. They care about solidifying their station in life. They're corporate robots for the most part. What do you think about that, Rebecca?
I mean, I would say I do everything I can to avoid being a corporate robot. Like, if you met me, I think the last thing you would say is that, Rebecca, she's a corporate robot.
Right. Yeah, I would say, and again, what is he talking about? Corporate robots? Like, when I think of corporate robot, I think of like a Microsofty or a Boeing engineer or something. Someone who goes to work at 8 and works in a cubicle and has a identifying, you know, an ID card and toes the line and is very conforming. And when I think about therapists, I think of the direct opposite of that. I mean, if we're going to go like stereotypical therapist, we're talking about an ex-hippie who, you know, uses tarot cards and
to solve their friends' problems.
And you know, that's tarot, you know, corporate robot and tarot cards don't go hand in hand. Let's just put it that way. So again, I'm just like, what are you talking about? The other thing is he's saying most therapists don't really care about helping you. And I'm like, certainly it depends on what we mean by care, but I would venture to say that the vast majority of therapists, at least when they're starting out, really do care. They want to help human beings. There's so many other things they could have done with their time and energy and money with their master's degree that have less to do with caring about people. If you're thinking about another career or furthering your career and you don't care about human beings, get a master's in business. Get a master's in marketing. Not that those people don't care about people, but it's much more self-serving because you're much more likely to make a lot of money, you know, whereas getting a master's or even a doctorate, I suppose, in counseling or psychotherapy is not, you know, it's not typical that people are like, ha ha, I'm in it for the money. You know, it's more like, I really care about human beings. How can I make money and try to make a difference in the world? You know what I mean? So anyway, another quote here is, and this is the exact reason most of them do not like me, because I actually help clients. Again, arrogant prick. Another quote here, only about 3% of individuals in therapy actually need therapy. Now, you commented on this earlier. You're just like, that is not true, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, if I were to think about the people that come here, in fact, most of my clients say things like, I really need to come in. Or like just today, I said to a client, hey, I'm going to be gone these weeks. And he said, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to have a crisis if you're not there. Like, you know, we're kind of an intricate part of each other's lives.
Right. And the thing, people say this sometimes, and where they're like, you know, the worried well, or no one really needs therapy. And the thing I say to that is, that's an extremely complicated thing to talk about. Because what do we mean by need therapy? It depends on the eye of the beholder. I'm sure that this arrogant prick, if he were to talk with all my clients, he would probably determine that most of them don't, quote unquote, need therapy according to his criteria. But they are, in my assessment, my clients are benefiting from therapy. But do they need it? Do you know what I mean? Or would they die without it? No, they're not going to die without it. Would they die if I went on vacation for a couple of months? No. So now I get the impression you have clients that are perhaps more in need of therapy. But the point is that it depends on what we mean by need. The other thing is there's a lot of different populations in therapy. I mean, you have people who are schizophrenic. You have people who are suicidal. You have people who are severely autistic. You have people who are
severe PTSD, aren't functioning because of their PTSD symptoms. Like,
right, who can't step out of the house because of PTSD or agoraphobia or something. And they need therapy. There's no doubt about that. You have a different set of people where, say, there's a lot of family conflict. Maybe there's conflict between the spouses. That's a different, shall we say, category of clients. Do those people need therapy? You know, it depends on what you mean by need. So there's, yeah, you could, but for an arrogant prick to just blanketly say, I have determined that about 3% of individuals in therapy actually need therapy. Just that sentence alone is an ignorant statement. It's like, unless you say something like, according to my definition, or some might say, or something like that, but just to blanketly say only 3% of individuals in therapy actually need therapy is just decries ignorance. Another quote here. A lot of analysts, so that's another quote, that's another indication he's probably in Connecticut, right? Because it's like...
Right, who's an analyst anymore?
Right, like I don't know a single analyst in Seattle. There are some, but they're very rare. Anyway, a lot of analysts have simply become the lost parent that the child needs to talk to once in a while, the lost parent that isn't threatening you and you don't know any of their foibles. What do you say to that, Rebecca?
And sometimes, yes, like right. I am the client's, I am parenting that person
right.
in many ways. And that's not bad.
Right. That's exactly what I think. I'm so glad you agree. Is that it's like, yeah, exactly. That's the healing nature of therapy is that the deficits, particularly when you're mistreated and neglected as a child that your parents put you through, one of the best ways to heal from that is through therapy and through absorbing a sort of parental version of therapy in which the therapist is listening. It's more of a one-way relationship. You care. You maybe even provide a little bit of feedback. You don't judge. It's a parental relationship. Yeah, that's what differentiates therapists. I was just telling a supervisee this yesterday because she has this client who is not listening to her as she's trying to teach her cognitive behavioral skills. You know, so she's like, I keep trying to tell her, you know, how to use the skills, and she keeps not doing it, and she keeps asking me for help, and I keep giving her skills, and she keeps coming back, and she's not doing it. And I'm like, okay, so fine, you want to teach skills, which is great. There's nothing wrong with skills. Skills are great. But that's not what differentiates us from a workbook. What differentiates us from a workbook is a human relationship with someone who cares, with someone who is trained to provide a healing environment for someone who was damaged by relationships in the past. And so in all likelihood, that's what the client is looking for, and they're not looking for skills. And if it was that easy and it was just skills, then they would go on the internet and say, how do I manage my emotions, you know, or how do I have a good life, or how do I have a good marriage, or how do I not get angry at people? Like, if it was that simple, then yeah, by all means, teach people cognitive behavioral skills. But it's 99% of the time, it's not that easy. And the real work gets into the relationship. And so yeah, you know, I agree that we have become the lost parent, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that is exactly the dogma that I hear a lot of brief therapists say, is like, well, you know, those other therapists, all they're interested in is just like recreating a, they just want to be a parent, as if that's a bad thing, you know,
right, like as if people don't need that.
Right. It's just like, it's disgusting that you would be dependent. And that's another reason why it's a lot of men who talk this way, because men are socialized to abhor dependence and to humiliate it as a female attribute or something. And so, like, there's just all this disdain around, like, therapy being a place for people to get enriching dependency. You know, it's like it's very threatening to their defense structure, which probably is a result of the fact that they were neglected as kids and hate their inner dependency themselves. If I might be so bold, if I might be an arrogant prick to another arrogant prick,
just prick it out. Just
So I think that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself. Why should people take care of themselves?
It's a good lifelong goal, I think, to take care of yourself.
Indeed.
And you can do it. You can do it.
You can
reach that goal.